Great artists are not always known for their modesty. It takes confidence to get up and sing for 3,600 people. That may seem like a small number compared to a worldwide movie audience, but when a singer takes the stage at Lyric Opera of Chicago, those people are not just an idea, a virtual audience on the other side of a camera lens. Those 3,600 people are in the room staring at you. Now imagine the pressure on a composer at the premiere of a new work. They are going to be held responsible for the whole opera. You would think that would make composers sympathetic spectators. But 19th century French composer Hector Berlioz was a particularly demanding audience member. Although he was a published critic for most of his adult life, if he heard something he didn't like in performance, it was not his habit to wait until he could collect his thoughts and put pen to paper. His memoirs record his reaction to a performance at the Paris Opera of Iphigénie en Tauride by Berlioz's hero, Christoph Willibald Gluck. "I contained myself until the piece was finished," he wrote, "and then, seizing the occasion of the momentary lull that preceded the next piece, I shouted out with all my might, 'There are no cymbals there! Who has dared to correct Gluck?'" Gluck himself had been dead for a century, but Berlioz was his self-appointed champion. He was capable of worse. At a different performance, Berlioz incited a riot, which ended in audience members smashing instruments and breaking chairs. Even Berlioz seems to have been appalled by what he started on that occasion. My name is Anthony Freud, and since I'm the general director of Lyric Opera of Chicago, I beg you to keep your own reactions when in the opera house more measured. But my point is that art mattered in Berlioz's time, just as it matters today. And Berlioz was running risks far beyond the other composers of his day. This commentary is about one of the greatest and most daring works in the history of opera, Hector Berlioz's 4-plus-hour opera about the fall of Troy and the founding of Rome, Les Troyens, the Trojans. The musical excerpts in this commentary are furnished courtesy of Warner Music Group, the official education and promotional music provider of Lyric Opera. The recording features Régine Crespin as both Cassandra and Dido, Guy Chauvet as Aeneas, Marie-Luce Bellary as Anna, and Jean-Pierre Hutot as Narbal. Georges Prêtre conducts the chorus and orchestra of the Paris Opera. And special thanks to Nicholas Ivor Martin for writing this commentary. Berlioz was hardly the only megalomaniac composer in the history of opera. But he and his masterpiece came into the world at a special time and place. It was composed between 1856 and 1858 and premiered in an abridged form at the Théâtre Lyrique in Paris in 1863. Nationalistic and revolutionary politics were everywhere, and they couldn't help but affect the arts. The more modest Giuseppe Verdi was in those same years being hailed by crowds across the Italian peninsula. The patriotic choruses in his operas, starting with Va Pensiero from his 1842 opera Nabucco, were as well known for their political as for their artistic statements. By 1859, posters were appearing in Italy with the letters of the composer's last name, Verdi, used as an acronym to mean Vittorio Emanuele Re d'Italia. Victor Emmanuel was the monarch put forward by the nationalists as a king for a unified Italy. That same year, Richard Wagner completed his opera Tristan und Isolde, which would premiere in Munich in 1865. Wagner had already gotten himself in trouble dabbling in revolutionary politics, but he had moved on to making a revolution in the musical world. Tristan divided opera history into before and after by its use of dissonance, its association of musical phrases with characters and themes in the story, and its pacing. Set number opera, in which an aria ended, then was followed by recitative, then another aria, then an ensemble, would henceforth look old-fashioned, stodgy. Wagner's music would flow from the first note to the last, stopping only for intermissions. But Wagner was already hard at work on a far more ambitious project, his Ring of the Nibelung. The Ring would ultimately contain 4 operas and more than 15 hours of music. It premiered in its complete form in 1876 at the Bayreuth Festival, a festival and theatre built specifically to present Wagner's massive operas. Wagner needed his own theatre because of the technical demands of his ring, but he was also trying to erase the dominance of Paris as the performance capital of opera, a dominance it had maintained in spite of the enormous successes of Italian and German composers. Opera in the middle of the 19th century was no longer merely entertainment. Verdi had connected with the common man, and his music became intertwined with the nationalist yearnings of Sicilians, Romans, Genoese, and Neapolitans to become Italians. The Italian Risorgimento was not an isolated phenomenon. Nationalism as a political force had swept out of Prussia in the late 18th century to engulf Europe and her colonies worldwide. Napoleon's nearly successful occupation of all Europe was a living memory. His defeat at Waterloo had occurred on June 18, 1815, when Verdi and Wagner were 2 years old and Berlioz was 12. The realm of art and of ideas could not help but be affected by the political convulsions of the 19th century. While Napoleon, Otto von Bismarck, and Giuseppe Garibaldi were building corporeal empires, artists, philosophers, and composers were seeking their own theory of everything, reaching for ideas of universality on a massive scale. Wagner succeeded. His enormous orchestras, powerful singers, and extended-length programs, coupled with the sheer size of his ambitions, would make him the standard against which future composers would all be judged. By 1876, Verdi had already premiered dozens of operas. Many of them, La Traviata, Il Trovatore, Nabucco, Don Carlos, wildly successful. But even Verdi would have to react to Wagner and his concept of a total work of art, the Gesamtkunstwerk. By contrast, Berlioz's masterwork was nearly forgotten for a century after its premiere. If Berlioz's immediate success was less, it was not because his ambitions were more modest or his musical inventiveness less radical. With the Trojans, Hector Berlioz set out to create his own Gesamtkunstwerk before most people had ever heard the word. The thing about world domination is that it inevitably creates more losers than winners. So most would-be emperors have found it good public relations to claim that really you don't have anything to worry about because this is not something new, it already existed. Artistic empire builders could claim a historical mandate by pointing to forms and composers who went before. But for Berlioz and Wagner, both of whom were trying to change those forms, a more malleable source of legitimacy was national myth. The highest art form for opera in the 18th century was opera seria, which often took its stories from ancient Greece. In a clever twist, Wagner would use German epics like Tristan, Parsifal, and the Nibelungenlied to reference that past while emphasizing his own pan-German beliefs. Like Wagner, Berlioz took the unusual step of writing his own libretto. But Berlioz, though a revolutionary in many things, chose a source closer to the opera seria tradition than Wagner. His masterwork would take its story from the foundational myths of both Greece and Rome, the Trojan Wars and the founding of Rome, as written down by Virgil in his Latin epic poem, the Aeneid. Berlioz was literally a lifelong devotee of the poet. He was reading Virgil's poetry in Latin and translating it into French by the time he was 12. The composer's artistic models were all men whose grasp was as large as his own. He idealized Gluck, Virgil, Beethoven, and Shakespeare, bragging that he wept when he read Virgil's poetry. Just as Homer's Odyssey is the story of Odysseus, Virgil's Aeneid recounts the life and travels of Aeneas, a relative of King Priam of Troy, and therefore a descendant of Ilus, the founder of Troy. Homer's other epic, the Iliad, is about the fall of the city founded by Ilus. The Trojans opens in Troy at the end of the war that would forever erase Ilus's city from the maps of Asia. That Berlioz begins his opera apparently in the middle of the story is no accident. Homer's Iliad starts in the middle of the action as well, as does the Aeneid. As a literary device, This was common enough to earn a Latin term, in media res, or into the middle of things. For Berlioz, this was more than just a way to open with a bang. His opera is in five acts, another bow to the tradition of French grand opera. But a single evening of five acts was scant time in which to cram Virgil's sprawling narrative. Les Troyens is extremely episodic, jumping through Virgil's original with a structure more like an oratorio than an opera. The abridged 1863 premiere at the Théâtre Lyrique would include only the final three acts, and even those were heavily cut. This might seem like a strange choice, but Berlioz's opera divides neatly into two parts. Acts 1 and 2 are set in Troy, at the end of the war. Acts 3 through 5 are set in Carthage, where Aeneas meets and falls in love with Dido, the queen of Carthage. Part 1 of the opera opens with the Trojans celebrating what they think is a happy end to their 10-year war with Greece. The Greeks have left a wooden horse, which the besieged take to be an offering to Athena. They don't realize it's a trap. The horse is filled with Greek soldiers. In a military blunder on a par with Napoleon's invasion of Russia, the Trojans bring the horse inside the walls and throw a victory party. The action draws the condemnation of Cassandra, the daughter of King Priam and Queen Hecuba of Troy. As a name, Cassandra is a variant of Alexandra, and can be translated as protector of man. Cassandra warns her compatriots not to trust the horse, but no one listens, and today we find the word Cassandra in the dictionary defined as a person who prophesies doom or disaster. Even in the dictionary, she gets no credit for having been right. She is, however, the heroine of part one of Berlioz's opera. As I've hinted, Berlioz was traditional in many of his choices for the Trojans. The opera is not through composed, but made up of traditional arias, recitatives, and ensembles. It follows the five-act form prescribed for French grand opera, and it uses Greek mythology as its source material. In these ways, it was just the kind of set-piece opera that Wagner was trying to make obsolete. But Berlioz's music is anything but traditional. In the excerpt you just heard, you can tell that Cassandra is troubled, her thoughts and speech disjointed. Berlioz was one of the most important classical orchestrators of all time. His book on orchestration is still read today. But his ability to use music to express human thought and emotion was his greatest achievement, one that is nearly unparalleled in the annals of music. After the horse is brought into Troy, sealing the city's fate, the hero Aeneas, or Aene in French, is visited by the ghost of Hector, who tells him to flee Troy and go to Italy. There he will found a new Troy. Hector is talking about Rome. In 146 BCE, the expanding Roman Republic would conquer and absorb Greece. Our world today is dominated by states structured according to political precepts of representation and governance developed by the ancient Romans. But the same ancient Romans revered and stole on a massive scale Greek culture. Virgil wrote his Aeneid between 29 and 19 BCE, just as Augustus was picking up the pieces from Caesar's rule and assassination and the subsequent civil war. Virgil's epic of a Trojan warrior hero who flees the destruction of the Trojan War to found a new Troy was political propaganda for the new regime. Les Troyens is about prophecy and fate. Cassandra's prophecy and Hector's appearance to Aeneas are not meant to be taken as quirky, slightly humorous theatrics. They're meant to impress us with the weight of mystery. It is here that Berlioz's ability to evoke emotion through music is at its most powerful. As the sack of Troy is in progress, the Trojan women recognize that Cassandra's prophecies were correct. they pray to the goddess Cybele for help. Part 1 of Les Troyens ends with Cassandra persuading the women of Troy to commit mass suicide rather than be taken alive by Greek soldiers. The remaining three acts, though no less portentous, are more concerned with love than war. Dido, the queen of Carthage, fears for her kingdom. Her Numidian neighbours are marching against her, and she no longer has the support of her husband, who's died. Aeneas has arrived in disguise with his men, and he agrees to defend Carthage. Dido could not be more different from Cassandra, a point Berlioz drives home with Dido's first entrance. Where Cassandra is tortured and gloomy, Dido is strength personified. French opera would not be grand without a ballet, and the first scene of Act 4 is one of the most massive and famous ballets in all opera. The Royal Hunt and Storm depicts how Dido and Aeneas fall in love after taking shelter in a cave from a storm while hunting. Composer Charles Gounod said about his friend Hector Berlioz that, like his great namesake Hector, he died beneath the walls of Troy. He was referring to Berlioz's attempts to get his magnum opus performed. I mentioned that the 1863 premiere was given in an abridged form. The scope and difficulty of Berlioz's masterwork was so gigantic that performing it would present enormous challenges. Originally conceived for the Paris Opera, that theatre ultimately refused to present it after having strung the composer along for 5 years. The theatre felt it was simply too massive. In one of history's great ironies, the Paris Opera replaced Trojans with Wagner's Tannhäuser. Berlioz wanted the Paris Opera to do Trojans and had to settle for the Théâtre Lyrique, while Wagner accepted the Paris Opera when he wanted the Lyrique. Wagner had to insert a ballet he did not want to satisfy the Paris Opera's rules about operatic form, and the Tannhäuser premiere was heckled so mercilessly it caused the composer to withdraw it after only 3 performances. That the Paris Opera felt Tannhäuser was easier than Trojans said something about the scale of the latter. But if the Trojans was the pinnacle of Berlioz's operatic career, it represented an evolution, not a break, from what had come before. In his 1830 Symphonie Fantastique, the composer established his supremacy in expressing dramatic ideas in musical form. His first opera, Benvenuto Cellini, premiered in 1836 and was a sprawling work of daunting musical complexity. In his treatise on orchestration, Berlioz fantasized about how to compose a piece that would require the services of every musician in Paris at the time to perform, which he reckoned at 60 first violins, 60 second violins, 40 violas, 45 cellos, and on and on. The Trojans was not that big, but its pit orchestra of double and triple winds and quadruple horns had to be supplemented by dozens of musicians playing backstage. And the length and orchestration are not the only obstacles to performance. The ballet, which includes nymphs, sylvans, fauns, and, as you heard, a chorus, was supposed to feature a waterfall with real water diverted from the nearby River Seine. Experiments during the rehearsal process convinced the theatre to opt instead for a painted waterfall, one of the many disappointments suffered by the composer in trying to see his work realised. Wagner and Berlioz were both forging a new kind of opera that was bigger than the opera houses of their day, both literally and figuratively. But Wagner carried audiences in his own day in a way that would be denied to Berlioz. Unlike Wagner, who would proudly premiere his Ring in 1876, Berlioz would not live to see a complete performance of The Trojans. An uncut performance was not given until 1890, 20 years after the composer's death. It took another half century for audiences and artists to rediscover Berlioz's greatness as a composer, and in particular, the genius of his greatest work. In the final scenes of the opera, Aeneas struggles with his divided loyalties. The gods demand that he abandon Dido to fulfill his destiny and found Rome. But in a thrilling duet, Berlioz leaves us in no doubt about Dido and Aeneas's love for each other. There's a surprise in the text of the love duet, which you may spot if your French is good. Berlioz idolized Shakespeare as much as Virgil, and he remembered that in The Merchant of Venice, Lorenzo woos Jessica, Shylock's daughter, by comparing himself to famous lovers, every one of them doomed: Troilus, Pyramus, Jason, and of course Aeneas. Shakespeare introduces each lover with the words, "In such a night as this," and Berlioz uses the same words to introduce each stanza of the duet. Torn though he is, Aeneas realizes that he cannot cheat fate. He breaks the news to Dido that he must leave her. She curses him. In the final scene, she commits suicide as the Trojans sail away. She predicts that from her ashes a glorious avenger will be born to punish Aeneas. Her sentiments are echoed in the final bars, when the Carthaginian people pour out undying hatred for Aeneas and his descendants.